This morning, we're being treated with a government document, as I've just been told here. So it's not copyrightable. Head of the recorded sound section of the Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division at the library is our first speaker, Sam Brolofsky. 26 years at the library, formerly a preservation engineer at the LC Recording Laboratory, later a reference librarian and a curator for recordings. Most recently, he was the curator of the Bob Hope Gallery of American Entertainment. Matter of fact, Bob Hope just went to the hospital this morning. They say it's not life-threatening, though. And the inaugural exhibit of the Bob Hope Gallery, Bob Hope and American Variety. So here is Sam Brolofsky.
Thank you. No, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for getting up and being here, your hearty souls. I have a lot to cover here because I have about almost 2.5 talks in one that I'm going to try to get through just to give you an overview of what the library is doing, how we're planning, what the plans are and how we're planning, basically. But it is sort of two slideshows in one, as you'll see, and it is... I can't stand and do it with the way Ms. Gassaway did. That was very impressive. Nothing spinning on mine, I'm afraid. Not even discs. In any case, I came to ARSC a few years ago, I believe it was in Syracuse, and told you a little bit about what is called the National Audiovisual Conservation Center, which is being planned for Culpeper, Virginia. The Conservation Center is the fruition, or will be, we hope, of the vision of the chief of Motion Picture Broadcasting Recorded Sound, MBRS, David Francis, who is a British citizen who set up a conservation center there primarily for motion pictures outside of London under the philosophy of getting all the collections under one roof and having the laboratory to deal with the collections there as well as the curators and catalogers who have to conserve and preserve the collection. The Library of Congress audiovisual collections, the motion pictures, radio and television programs, recorded sound, are now in, I don't know, 3 or 4 states and about almost 6 locations. We have our nitrate preservation laboratory is in Dayton, Ohio. Our vaults for nitrate film are in Dayton, Ohio. We have our preservation tapes, our masters, audio stored in Boyers, Pennsylvania, National Underground Storage. We have materials in Virginia now, Maryland, in addition to Capitol Hill. So David came to the library about almost 10 years ago now with an idea of bringing them under one roof, having been a consultant out in Dayton, and had a vision to have a conservation center in the country, as he said, away from the pollution where everything could be under one roof in a custom-built facility. And the library said to him, that's a great idea, you know, good luck raising money for it, you know, because we're not going to Congress for it. We have other needs. And so it was sort of, endorsement, but not real, active support. But we discovered a facility in Culpeper, Virginia, and I want to tell you a little bit about the facility and what we're doing and how we're going to renovate this facility in all hope. In any case, in 1997, President Clinton signed into law a authorization for the library to acquire this property by gift and name this facility the National Audiovisual Conservation Center. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the building as it is now, our plans for the building, our sort of philosophy of how things will change in terms of our collections, preservation, cataloging when we go into the building, and then also a little bit about preservation, well, a lot about preservation, but just one aspect of it. When we go to this facility, which is planned for early 2003, we expect about 75 members of our staff to go there. Almost everyone except for a few curators and the reference staff will be working in Culpeper, Virginia. I think I said it's about 80 miles southwest of Washington, 2/3 of the way to Charlottesville, Virginia. The staff there will include catalogers and a very large preservation staff, because it's very obvious to us and necessary that the preservation of sound recordings there will be a far more complicated and, we hope, permanent project, program than it is now. And when I talk about the complexity, that's much of what I'm going to talk about today, is how some of the preservation or management of our preservation data will work. At the heart of the facility will be not just the collections and people to take care of them, but what we call a digital repository. And this is a little bit about what I'm going to talk about here. I hope I can read this. The facility itself was a Cold War facility built by the Federal Reserve Bank in Richmond. And I'm going to show it to you in a few slides. But it was a building built underground outside of Culpeper with the idea of this facility would be for the storage of currency, maybe stamps, in the case of a nuclear disaster. And as you know, you've probably read about, there are a lot of facilities like this within 100 or 200 miles of Washington, D.C. There's one under a hotel in West Virginia that the President and Congress were going to be housed. And this is one for the Federal Reserve Bank. And as you see, as I say, a multi-purpose facility that's going to be for the original collections. It's going to include a theater. There are going to be really three laboratories there, ultimately, one for sound recordings, one for motion pictures, nitrate motion pictures, and a video with a video component. And then our funder is very interested in digital preservation of film and wants to see sort of an evolving facility for film digital preservation, which is really much in the future. I mean, that's really not feasible now, but it will be. This is a picture of the facility from the roof of the facility. It's, as I told you, was a vault and storage vaults and offices and living quarters for 300 people, members of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. The Richmond District sort of is the mid-Atlantic states. The Federal Reserve System is divided into six or seven different regions. This particular facility, in the case of a nuclear holocaust, would also have the computer facilities for the Federal Reserve Bank. So even though the world would be pretty much only cockroaches, the monetary system would move on, just as, you know, just as Lyndon LaRouche has warned you. It's a three-story building, 140,000 square foot, and on the top floor, I'm sort of standing on the top floor here, taking a picture of this guard tower that's at the top of the facility. You can see sort of on the right that little white square is the little gun turret, the little hole for the gun to shove through to shoot people who try to get money out of this system. When I was young, I loved the film Goldfinger and sort of this attack on Fort Knox, and this is very much like living in that. I mean, there's security upon security, you know, safeguards everywhere, lots of, I didn't bring a picture of the firing range, but the facility includes a firing range and lots of little holes to shove rifles through.
And never get a record out of LC again.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I don't like that word again, but I'll move on. Anyway, you applaud, but I have to report this now, you know. This is a photo of the entrance of the facility. The top is a going across the top, you can see is sort of the only windows in the facility, the second floor. We're gonna punch a lot more windows in it when we renovate it. I said the facility wasn't ever really used for funding. I understand it was used to store Susan B. Anthony dollars and gas coupons of the late 1970s. The facility really is built like a fortress, literally, in all ways. We've done stress testing on the floors, and we can have as heavy collections as we have on both the first and second floor. And while it's very sturdy, it is somewhat drab as it is. As you can see, this is the main lobby. There are you know, you come in and, you know, you sort of go through several levels of security, and you're seeing in the background there sort of the guard station. This will be completely gutted. There's no plans to make this a very fancy and ornamented place, but there will be a small theater in it. As I said, we had this vision for the facility, and the library administration said, good luck. But then we, through great fortune, we were developed a relationship with David Woodley Packard, who is the son of the co-founder of Hewlett Packard, and an enormous fan of vintage motion pictures and sound recordings as well. He has his own foundation, which is called the Packard Humanities Institute, which is a little separate from the David and Lucille Packard Foundation. With this foundation, he's renovated a theater in downtown Palo Alto, California, where he lives, and has Packard is doing well. This foundation is very, you know, successful, you know, flush, and he's really anxious to support cultural programs with it, particularly for, I guess, what I would call pre-war popular culture, as well as opera. I mean, he's supporting an opera program at Harvard, I think, and, you know, a music editing program, right, Ginny? If you're here, in any case. The facility, to get this thing renovated, we have arranged it so that the Packard Humanities Institute, or the David and Lucille Packard Foundation, I forget which one right now, actually owns this facility, and it'll be renovated with their money while they own it. Congress will kick in some amount of money toward it. We're not sure exactly how much. We think it's limited to about $15 million. The Packard is committed to contribute another $45 million, but he has a lot of ideas for things that should be there, like this digital preservation laboratory for film, you know, research and development lab, a theater, and he has these ideas, and when they're not crazy, and they haven't been, we say, well, fine, if you want it and want to put more money toward it, we'd be delighted, and that's what's happened. Just an enormous, incredible opportunity for us. So here, this is the freight facility right now. I'm sort of enamored of the freight facility. I thought I'd explain it to you now because, as I say, I have this sort of Goldfinger obsession. But let's see how this was. A truck would go into this entrance, would turn right into this entrance, and then turn toward, you know, where the camera is now, and then back up into that freight dock, which is all the way at the rear of this photo. Now, here's a picture of the freight dock. If you look, there's that big orange screen that would close behind the truck that's unloading, you know, our currency. And then it would be unloaded here on the freight dock, go into this vault. You can see the vault door there, this giant Mosher door, which is about, you know, maybe 15 inches thick and weighs tons, and then would be in these, from there, the currency or whatever would be in these, in two large vaults on the first floor. These vaults will hold the heaviest materials in the collections. We sort of have a debate with the motion picture people. Is their stuff the heaviest, or are our lacquer discs the heaviest? I contend that our glass-based lacquer discs are the heaviest collections in at least our division. I don't know. But right now, we're in the process of the library of planning for the renovation of the facility, which is really with the assumption that most of the facility will be gutted. Although there are motion pictures on the third floor now, we've already moved them out of some of our less than ideal spaces, remote storage spaces, and put them here where they are now stored under a constant 55 degree temperature. But the planning for it is, I don't want to go into a lot of it because it is still planning and there's a lot of things up in the air, but the way it looks now is there will be, I mean, this is a fact, there probably will be as many as about 15 to 20 separate vaults built within this vault area. And the separate vaults will enable us to keep parts of the collection separated from one another, which is one of the sort of important rules that we're building this facility by, separating our master material from our access material. If we make a preservation tape, the master will be in one vault. It'll be completely isolated from the other vault where the preservation material is. In addition, moving there gives us the opportunity of doing much more inventorying and better sleeving and going back and sort of re-looking at how we've shelved our collections, how we've housed them. We're designing lots of new packages for them and hope to be able to, you know, share the results of that with you next year, showing you some of the packaging, some of the solutions that we've come to. The separation of things. The big project we're in the middle of now is actually counting the collections, counting them, multiplying them, looking at the packaging, how much will the packaging expand the volume of the collections and fitting them into the collection. We're looking at a 25-year growth in this building right now. We're hoping that it provides enough room for the staff, for the new digital programs, and 25 years of growth. I think that's a little optimistic, and it might be, you know, 20 years or something like that. The vaults, the building itself is about 450 feet long, and there's been a lot of discussion with the architects and the engineers about how to, you know, heat and cool these vaults. Because the building is built into a hill, into a mountain, it's mostly underground, we expect it to be very efficient. There's sort of an idea of the corridor on the third floor and how long it is. The idea is this long building has a space behind it the space behind it was really, since it was built into a hill, to allow the hill sort of to fall, you know, down a little more without crushing in the wall. So there's this large volume of, you know, space behind the building, between the building and the back of the hill. They call it the body drop area because of the rumors of this facility in the point of a Cold War, and after everybody starts killing each other for the last can of beans, they would just drop the bodies behind this behind the building here. It's very important to us because it'll be the ventilation area. What we'll do is we'll have all of the HVAC units on top of the building and then run the vents right through this area. So we'll no longer have a place to drop the bodies. And in doing so, hopefully, you know, this way, having the shortest vent area is very efficient for a lot of reasons. Now that sort of ends part one, which is just sort of a look at the building. And the next part is sort of to tell you a little bit about the digital program plan for the facility. And I think this is actually, while having the opportunity to store these collections in an environment as good as we hope this will be is very exciting and a wonderful opportunity, this is really the most difficult and I think actually has the most potential for giving the rest of the archival world some help in planning for the future of preservation. Even if we fail in doing it, you know, we'll know that it doesn't work. But the idea is in a digital program here is to finally realize that there is going to be digitization for preservation. It's inevitable. We've talked about this for years for several reasons I'll go into in a minute. But we also hope to digitize the materials that we're going to provide research access to. I won't be talking this morning about the actual capture, that is the creation of digital files, the bit rates, the sampling rates, and what equipment will be used for the most part. That's something that's emerging. We're doing some testing now. I'll talk about that in a second. But in terms of what the sampling rates are and how the actual capture, you know, I looked at that laser turntable. That might be one way to do it through for the digitization we do for playback. But as you see some of the rules here that we're thinking about, and that is, you know, these will be stored as computer files. When we say, you know, digitization, it won't be the creation of CDs. It'd be, you know, CDRs as WAV files. There will have an incredible dependency on automation for the management of these files. And that is what I think you'll see from what I'm going to talk about is the greatest challenge of this is the management of the automation or of the files themselves. And then I'll talk a little more about the fact that all these years we've talked about why we don't digitize for preservation. And I think generally archivists have two reasons why. One has been the amount of compression necessary to make an archival copy or image of a sound recording. And the other is the fact that there is no medium which we have, you know, deemed permanent. And I've come to believe, as have my colleagues, most of them, that, you know, waiting for the media, the perfect medium, is useless, because there never will be one. There never will be a permanent medium. So we sort of have begun to talk about formatless preservation. That is to say, if they're files and we're going to manage files and we're going to accept the fact that they might be on this kind of cassette this year, but they have to be ready to put on another kind of cassette the next year. And if they're digital files with proper proper means of checking the integrity of the copy, checksums and things, we can plan a system that just calls for the inevitability of constantly copying it onto another format. I say constantly, maybe every 5 years, but maybe every year they'll be testing. As you may know, Sony Records has a pretty interesting digital facility set up now, which has a in which they're copying materials, and they are then have the tapes themselves in sort of a silo, a robotic silo. At night, the machine, the arm, comes out and checks tapes for the integrity of them to see whether anything is degrading and copies them. These so-called shortcomings of the classic model you're very aware of in terms of the generation loss of analog copies and we've been crying wolf about audio tapes not being made and open reel machines not being made for years here. And then there is also just advantages of a digital copy in terms of the kinds of access that we can do. At the same time, there's a lot of anxiety about this. And we're very aware of it. And as I said earlier, we're working on this, and we're going to come to you in a few years and, might just well say, this is not working. I think that renovating, I think it's our responsibility, the responsibility of institutions, to at least try this out and try to go someplace, because we know that the original, or rather that classic model, does have some built-in limitations. The idea for preservation is to, we've set some pretty high goals for the first 5 years. The idea is 100,000, preserving 100,000 items in 5 years. I think that's awfully high. I don't know whether it can be done, but it's a goal. One thing to do is a library receives through copyright about 10,000 audio cassettes per year. And we're trying to, hoping for the same time, I said I wouldn't talk about capture, but some sort of automated way just to get those copyright cassettes. They're generally not, a lot of them are homemade, a lot of them are from the foreign produced, because if we can, we try to get a CD. But we all know that they're, the disposable razor blades of our media, and that we should try to copy them. Maybe it might be useful to try to copy them immediately and just get them into a system as we receive them. At the same time, I don't think that I think that most of the film and video archives are so obsessed with nitrate film and vinegar syndrome of acetate film and the problems of celluloid that they're just beginning to think about the video holdings they have and the fact that a VHS tape isn't really much different than an audio cassette. So there's thought that we might we will try to copy some of the video media at the same time. Still, in our sort of belt and suspenders philosophy, we will continue to store the originals, and we will continue simultaneous analog duplication for the foreseeable future. I hope we don't do it for long. I hope this is successful, we don't have to, but we will do it for the time being. The other thing, the classic question is, you're moving 80 miles from Washington. What happens to researchers? Do researchers have to go to Culpeper? Well, if researchers have a demand for the original item, the Michael Beals of the world who want to look at that lacquer or and really, you know, and study original items will have to go to Culpeper, and there will be a small public facility there for serving the collections for people who need to see the originals. But most of it will be, as it says here, delivery on demand. That is that the playback service that we have now, you come in the reading room and you fill out a call slip and you wait somewhere between 10 minutes and 45 minutes to where, depending on where something is stored. And then a technician at the library plays it for you. And if you want to hear it more than twice, pretty much tough luck, although now we're starting to make sort of a DAT copy while we play things back and just erase it at the end of the session if somebody does have to hear things. But the idea in Culpeper is that there is a fiber optic line that exists from the Federal Reserve Bank era that connects this with Capitol Hill, and that there will be playback from Culpeper. Well, right now it's a floor away from the reading room, so in Culpeper it'll be 80 miles. But the goal is to actually preserve items that are called for. So there'll be two preservation streams. One will be the usual materials preserved that were mentioned in an earlier slide, the obsolescence of material, of hard things that where the hardware might be coming obsolescence, where the material's in danger at high cultural value, et cetera. But the other is actually to preserve everything that's called for by researchers. And in doing so, my hope is that we will be serving a constituency that's much broader than those who can come to Capitol Hill. Now, copyright, of course, is the big obstacle, but we're looking, hoping that sites can get licensed or congressionally authorized or authorized through the RIAA. I mean, if you were here for the copyright session yesterday, as the Recording Industry Association of America clamps down on all of the things that are going on that, for better or worse, are illegal, they all do have, just horrible PR and are considered the bad guys by most people, maybe as a somewhat compensation is trying to open up collections like those of the library that have been digitized to certain licensed sites, other libraries or museums around the country that could be wired to us through the internet. And I'm very confident that the intellectual property holders will allow that if we can assure them that at the destination, there's not going to be a wholesale duplication process going on. And that's always the problem. It's not making that one copy. It's what happens at the end of that road. Now, most of this planning for this is it's being done by several people at the library. I work on the moving of the collections and the housing and sort of the preservation priorities and lots of things, but not much on what I'm going to talk about here. Most of these slides have been done by our technical advisors, our coordinators. The main one is a fellow borrowed from the National Digital Library, the people who put up the American Memory Sites, the library's website of collections. Carl Fleischauer sort of has coordinated mostly digitization of images and text for the American Memory Site, which has now something like 5 million items on it, the papers of the presidents, Edison recordings, because they are public domain for the most part, and a lot of the ethnographic recordings of American Folklife Center, and things like, the complete, Matthew Brady collection, and City Views, et cetera. Anyway, Carl has a lot of experience in that in managing digital things, and he's been sort of coordinating how this administration of the digital data will take place. And that's what I want to talk about just for a few minutes. Basically, we're creating digital files, and that's really complicated. And I'll sort of show you what they're dealing with here briefly. One is the idea of metadata, which I know to a lot of people sounds like sort of a buzzword, but it's real, and you'll be hearing a lot more about it. Metadata is data about data. A catalog, in a sense, could be called metadata. That is, the typical catalog that you might see in a computer, but in this case, we are going to have these databases that store all kinds of information about the preservation and access copies we've made. And those catalogs are populated with what they call, or those databases are populated with what they call metadata. Now, what is it? Descriptive metadata is describing the collection, your catalog. your catalog card, you know, what would be on a catalog card. But in addition, the technical data. This is something that our recording laboratory has been coaxed to do for many years, and lots of places do it by hand, but it should be done in a machine-readable form, and that is to document exactly what you do to a recording when you preserve it. What size stylus did you use? Exactly what piece of equipment was used? This, of course, that's very important for a DAT, for instance, if you're using that. What size stylus, what speed, you know, things like that would be metadata, you know, actual information about how you have preserved an item. That's just one kind of descriptive metadata. Administrative metadata might be the copyright holders, might be sort of the donors, donor restrictions, where you actually populate the database record with information on how, what kind of restrictions are on an item, or and we expect items to have different kinds of restrictions depending on what collection, what era, you know, as I say, on one end there's an Edison collection which is sort of public domain if we know the music is before 1923, and the other end is something that comes with a very heavy donor restriction in addition to other copyright restrictions. And then the third kind of metadata listed here is what he calls structural metadata. And that is recording things in the database that allow you to recreate the object based on your digital files. What I'm trying to say is any item that we preserve will be made up of several digital files. It's not one digital file. And those files together, those are the components of what we call a digital object. Now, what would that be? Well, if it's an LP, you have two files, one for each side of the LP. You have two more files of images from the labels, because this is what is built into this preservation program. As I said, it includes playback and includes the access materials. Therefore, it's a lot of commercial materials we'll be preserving, things that were normally outside of preservation. We're concentrating on unpublished materials for the most part. But for commercial materials and unpublished as well, the preservation process will include a scan, a high-quality scan of all of the print components of that item being preserved. The labels, the liner notes, the jackets, the J cards in a cassette, et cetera, you know, the whole brochure. And each one of those, as you know from scanners or digital cameras, each one of those is a separate file. And this is something, I think, one of the more complicated things the metadata will do is it allows the creation of a virtual digital object based on all these little files. And I'll show you a little more about that. But in any case, this is this slide here talks about various kinds of the catalogs that we use, the integrated library system, which is the library's catalog, the ILS. MAVIS, I won't go into MAVIS, but it's a very interesting subject in and of itself. It's the Merged Audiovisual Information System. It's a system designed, an Oracle-based catalog designed in the National Library of Australia for tracking copies of motion pictures and sound recordings, all the different generations of films and sound recordings in the preservation process. Teams is evaluate Teams asset management system. To the extent possible, we don't want to reinvent the wheel. We want to use existing tools for this type of work. And Teams is something developed by the Ortesia Corporation. I think their another name for it is Virage Software, and it's software used for text management. If you think about document on delivery, the companies that are now doing lots of scanning and OCR, and then you can go in and search what they have and pay for it, and it's delivered to you. The second key planning element of these eight is something I'll go through very fast, the uniform resource name, the URN. And what that is that you name a file, and there's a system devised now that's being worked on by people where the name of your file stays permanent no matter where it resides. And I mean, think about that. You know, you have something in your computer and it's under /my/documents/something. And you know, you get a new computer. Everyone has a computer that has /my/documents. And a uniform resource name will be a permanent name given to a file that will exist and be maintained no matter where that file is stored. Again, and what it is another database that just sort of keeps track of names. And this 856 field, that's a MARC field in the library catalog, a field that allows you to link to items. And it's being used a lot now to link to websites or link from websites. I've talked a little, I want to go fast to get through this, but I've talked about the digital object. And as I said, it's just a way to take these files and combine them into an item that can be used by researchers so that they can see the thing in one, in one system, in one workstation. I don't want to go too much. I mean, as I said, one of the great challenges of digital preservation is, all right, you've captured it. Now, what do you do with it? And that's what this is about. And one of it is how to manage these files through their what they call their life cycle. And one of them is what's called one of the things that's being used and is being worked on. And I'm trying to find where it's spelled out in my notes, but I don't see it. But this OAIS is a model. It's called the Open Archival Information System. And it's a model to manage things through life cycles. And I don't want to go into it. I'm sure most of you don't have a lot of interest in it. I'm sure there's a lot of literature on the web about it. But what it is sort of managing these digital objects. The whole point of a digital file in preservation is that you can regenerate them. You can keep them alive by copying them, backing them up, or archiving them. But to do so, they sort of have to have different forms in different phases of their life cycle. And one of them is what they call the SIP, the Submission Information Package. In other words, you feed the system X number of WAV files that you've identified as side one and two, or tracks one and whatever, and then there are the labels and the jackets, and that is the submission information package. And from there, the system itself is programmed to create an archival information package, and that is something that allows it to both play back, which they call the dissemination information package, and this isn't my terminology, this is a sort of standard terminology of people who are managing digital files. I mean, there isn't a lot going on now with it with audio and video things, but as you can imagine, in the text world and in the world of the web, there's a lot of research, a lot of very important work being done, and we're trying to use as much of it as possible. The presentation service is their word for playback. And that is, as I say, the dissemination information package. And what that is this goes back to that metadata. The metadata will, as I say, it stores where the label that goes with this item is so that the researcher will get a workstation that has this thing presented to them as an object, sort of the virtual copy of that LP. And I have a little demonstration of it, but I'm not sure I'm going to get to it. I'm going to try to go through these slides a little faster. Data preservation, in other words, built into this, and this is where the data is that there's two kinds of things being done, where you back up your files, and I mean that should be hopefully obvious to all of you. Just backing up these files, that's the beauty of a digital thing, is you can, as long as you can check the integrity of what you've done, you can easily back it up. But it's very important to people who manage the preservation of digital files that you also be able to archive it. And the difference between archiving it and backing it up is, if this is an Oracle database, which many large systems are, what happens if Oracle goes out of business? Do you really want to tie yourself to one proprietary system? So the idea of the difference between archiving is where you try to emulate the system it was created on. This is a lot of people, Jeff Rosenberg, if any of you have read his work, or doing this on trying to recreate the look and feel, in addition to the content of digital documents. Say a document created in 1980 on WordStar. And WordStar is hard to find now. What if it's an old version of WordStar and you really want to see exactly the way it looks like? There's research being done to sort of emulate the operating system that this thing was created under, in addition to the application software. In any case, that's sort of the difference quickly between archiving and backing up. We want to do both. We don't want to be dependent on one system. Now, as I said, access management, another thing is we hope to be able to share this, but so the items themselves, as they're cataloged, will have different, data that records what kind of access is available to them. Is there a donor restriction? Is there is there something that we could actually, maybe Sony has said, okay, you can take anything we own and you can share it with New York Public Library, with a museum, with a Harlem Jazz Museum being planned. If that happens, this thing will record that. And I hope I get the 45 minutes. I have about 5 minutes. A little bit here on what we're doing, the phases of development. Right now, there's planning, and the planning is entailed Now, we have a feasibility study where we actually are going to digitize, and there's a contract on the street now, as I say, a request for prices to start this, and doing, I think it's about 100 or 200 objects, I forget, to just start with this. So we have things to populate our test database. That is, not just the data, but the real digital files. At the same time, you know, we're planning the Culpeper physical facility, but, you know, also these systems. I see it's 600 to 1,000 items that they want to do. I sort of keep forgetting it. But right now, trying to just manage how we're going to deal with the information system at the library, the what's called ITS, Information Technology Office, and who's going to handle all this? Who's going to manage the handle server? That's this uniform resource name I mentioned. That's another database. It just keeps track of names of files. All this is being worked on now, and it's lots of different offices that I list here. The Preservation Directorate, which, you know, where Jerry Gibson works, which works on standards, and the IT servers. Who's going to run these servers? And then in the next few years, we've hired several contractors for this right now. Some that have been dealing with just designing the metadata structures and the databases for those. But then also, as I said, we're going to actually start some digital preservation this year as a prototype that's being outsourced. So here's a quick little schedule. I want to go through it fast about how, you know, what our timetable is. And as I say, we hope to move in 2003, but there's, you know, a lot going on between there. We'll have to do more fundraising, and you know, and all while this is going, we're doing preservation. How it might work? Someone might go into the reading room now under the watchful eye of Big Bird there. And order something. If it's been preserved or been requested recently, hopefully it's already digitized. But this is just a little mock-up of what the workstation might look like, and I wanted to show it to you very quickly, and I'm glad that I have time to do so. But basically, as you see on the left, is the structure of the digital object. You see that booklet container. Front cover, front image, cover back image, cover text. There might be a bigger thing. You know, we might even try to OCR the text. I'm not sure if it can be. But this is there is a workstation. This is the mock-up of the workstation that'll be used for the prototype. Up there in the upper right-hand corner is an about button, and that'll show some limited cataloging data. Then one could even click on the cover and get the a high quality image of the cover, of this case in an LP. Then looking at the structure of the booklet, this is a mock-up, so you see it sort of is a tango booklet inserted into a Ray Charles record. But what they call on the right in the digital, I don't know, delivery mode is what they call a thumbnail. You're probably familiar with that, where you can just sort of see small images of what it is you want to see, and then you can click on any of those and actually see the full text. That's sort of the result of what happens if you click the About button. You get some sort of very basic bibliographic data. And then the workstation itself would include a playback. Now, in this case, it's just a little Winamp application. And I don't want to go into Winamp, but it's very flexible. It's sort of out there, and everybody's doing something with it. What we've actually talked about doing is actually truly adhering to the sort of model of flat preservation and have the workstation have a built-in equalization. There might be a couple preset curves, or you might be able to actually play with an equalizer yourself while you are playing the recording back. In other words, that would be more in the hands of the researcher. Well, my time's about up, and I just sort of wanted to, you know, going back to sort of this little gun turret I love and thinking about this wonderful image of guns to culture, I guess, where we once kept, you know, prepared for a nuclear disaster and trying to safeguard these materials. And, you know, we'll be reporting to you as the years go by how successful we were. Thanks.
Instantaneous media. Is the library considering what we are away from?
Well, by considering, do you mean are we prepared for the day that nobody's making any playback media? Of course not. I mean, we're hoping that there's enough media out there that we're always going to be able to play things. The closest we've come to really, I mean, I say we're not prepared, but there is sort of constant monitoring, and the monitoring comes from talking to you all. I mean, I'll talk to, Seth, some of, the engineers here and find out, what is becoming obsolescent fastest. The best example of this are tape heads for 2-inch quad videotape. And this seems to be the first format to really be in danger of not being able to be played back. Now, this is rumor, but I understand there's only one company now that makes heads for a quad 2-inch playback. So that is our preservation priority right now. Right now, for video, that's what they're copying. They're getting all of that out, and it's being copied by, by private I think ViDiPax and other, Jim Lindner and other comparable laboratories that are very good at maintaining video equipment. So in that sense, yeah, they're monitoring, and if we see a real problem on the horizon, is there a problem with quarter-inch tape playback? Well, I mean, I know that there are fewer machines being made, but we're still some good studers out there, and we just bought some and we're very happy with, so we don't see it happening in the next few years. But, it's being monitored, but I can't, I hope we're not going to get caught. But the 2-inch tape is one case where they really are actively doing something. Tim?
For a researcher working off the Capitol Hill facility in the Franklin, mm-hmm. Would the turnaround time to get an item to Capitol Hill to the line about the same as now?
No, because it's about 10 minutes to an hour now, so it probably will be ahead of time. There's much more catalog. One thing that's happened that's part of this I haven't gone into is much more is cataloged and available online now. So you might be able to write us and say, I'm coming, this is what I'm interested in, I'll be there in 2 weeks, and we'd have it ready for you. In the old days at the library, we didn't know what we had till we looked. I mean, literally, someone like Tim would come in and maybe use a discography that exists and say, I'm looking for this, and we'd go look to see if we have it. Here, you'll be able to hopefully look from home to see what we have, tell us you're coming. But then on certain cases, when you have to see things, there will be, if we can deliver things to the Hill, we can. I mean, if we need to, we will, and that'll take a day or two. But we hope to have just a very short turnaround time to actually have copies made for playback, or they've already been made. Obviously, if they've already been made, you can just do it immediately. Well, we don't like to, if you come in and you say, I've got to hear all your, XYZ cylinders, I mean, they're obviously not going to make a big, if it's something that isn't rather routine to preserve, like an LP or something, it'll be hard to stop a preservation project to get, you say, well, this wire collection is unprocessed or unpreserved, we just got it, I want it tomorrow. No, that's not going to happen. Yeah, pardon me? Well, things will be much, we'll be able to find everything, which we can't always do now. All right, I'm getting the time. And we'll be able, which is good, I need to say. But things will be much more inventoried, so we're hoping it's better now. We're hoping it's a little longer time lag, but much more efficient, much better, because we'll know exactly what it is, and we're hoping that you'll be able to prepare at home for it, and we'll be ready when you come. And someday you'll be able to do it from, not home, I'm sure that won't be, but a local library.
Okay.
Thanks. You want to use this, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. Is that-